dad pulled me aside and was like, yo, man, the grades are flagging, and, you know, you maybe take a semester off and just focus on the band, because the band was really active. And
that was your dad's advice, was to take a year off school.
Yeah.
And you should try the rock and roll thing.
See what it was like, yeah. So his statement was, you don't need a degree to do what you want to do, which was assuming that it was valid.
Songwriter and artist David Bazan is my guest on episode 7 of the Etsy podcast. I'm your host, Justin McRoberts. David's been making music professionally since 1995, most notably as the frontman for Pedro the Lion, and more recently as a solo artist. Among the many things I enjoy about David is that he's not a brand, nor does he aspire to be. He is an artist. He's a man making music and musical culture that he believes benefits the lives of those who consume it. In our conversation, we get into his odd prophetic role in a religious culture that often considers him an outsider. We talk about the value of setting vocational goals but holding them loosely, and the extremely rare beginnings of his career, during which his parents quite literally encouraged him to quit school and give rock a try. One note about this podcast episode is that it's the first episode labeled explicit because of language. And I don't make this note to warn you about bad words and fear that you can't handle it. Instead, I want to use this opportunity to borrow on the brilliance of Christina Cleveland, who has more than once suggested that if I'm going to honestly and sincerely listen to someone else's story, I don't get to dictate the mode or tone of that person's storytelling. This podcast puts you in touch with great culture makers because I believe what they do deepens and enriches our lives. We've called it At Sea, in part because of the Nietzschean image that the sea is stormy, but that everything is at sea. A pursuit of human truth, then, necessarily leads me into waters that are wilder and well beyond my control. If you and I are to discover and hold up the goodness, truth, and beauty I believe permeates every square inch and every corner of this world, that will mean spending time in places that are unfamiliar and uncomfortable. One of the great values I find in David Bazan's work is not only his willingness to navigate unfamiliar and uncomfortable waters in his own world and in his own psyche, but also his relentless desire to invite you and I into those spaces with him. This podcast and this interview is one more opportunity to go there. Check it out. You have a Facebook impersonator. All of a sudden.
Well, there's been a couple.
There's kind of an arrival point there.
Oh,
where
yeah.
You're being, you know, there's someone pretending to. What's happening on Facebook with your Facebook impersonator?
Every now and again, there's somebody, and I don't know if it's the same person, but it's happened, I think, 3 times now. Because I don't have a personal Facebook page, so it kind of creates a vacuum for people to fill. And what we can gather is that it's somebody who, it never has gotten down the road far enough where anybody has been asked for their credit card info. So what has happened is that he generally only does friend requests for girls, women. And I feel like he's just sort of like trolling hot girls on.
He's like trolling hot Bazan fans.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much what's happening.
That's pretty amazing.
And so, like,
what a racket.
Each time it happened, I would wake up in the morning and get on, and, like, there would be some girl saying, hey, I think somebody's catfishing me with your account, you know, unless it's really you kind of thing. And I'm just like,
emoji,
rad. Like, I'm so sorry that this is happening. It's not me.
Yeah.
So then the process is pretty simple. I mean, an imposter Facebook account, my manager can, there's somebody that we have some connection with over at Facebook that we can just say, hey, can you guys, and they just take care of it right away. But
now he's the impersonator, this most recent, he's nicer than you are.
He's nicer.
He's way nicer.
Yeah.
Because he's offering free stuff.
Oh,
like,
man.
I saw the little, what it was.
What I tweeted.
Yeah.
About,
he said, where he was like, it's like, hey, you know, free tickets.
Free tickets. I'll
backstage
take you out to
passes,
dinner.
Take you out to dinner. I was like, I like this David Bazan. This is really
this
sweet.
David Bazan has no boundaries at all.
No.
His life is a nightmare.
It's really good.
Can you imagine if you did that? Like, you offered that 2 or 3 times? Like
all the time?
In the first week of your sort of career,
you'd
you're done.
You'd evaporate.
You're done.
Yeah. You would have any energy left.
I thought it was very funny though.
And the fact that like people clued into like, this isn't actually Dave.
This is not Dave.
Cause like he was being super, super nice and offering free things. I worry
that I'm falsely nice sometimes. And it's nice to have that contrast to realize, no, I'm actually not like, false.
Let's make it real clear.
Yeah. That's false niceness.
That is false niceness. You were 19 when you started Pedro.
Pedro, I was
in 95, mm-hmm. And I don't really do math, so that's just, we'll just say that's more than 10 years ago.
Yep. It's 17 years ago, I think.
So you just did math.
What is it?
You did bad math.
You know what? I was 19. No, it was 21 years ago. Sorry. I'm 40.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was doing years math, and I have the numbers. You're doing
like some of there's some dog ears in there, or fish ears. Which ones are the shorter ones? But the is there anything of your current reality that you expected? Like how much of your current reality looks like what you were sort of dreaming and thinking of, or was there a dream, or is it just sort of it was a hobby, and you didn't know there was a dream? I'm guessing how much of this looks like that.
I was just silly enough to, out of high school, I knew that I wanted to be a songwriter and a singer-songwriter for my job. Hmm. And so I set about to go to do that. I was living in Modesto. I had moved.
You were living in Modesto?
Yeah, I went to sophomore, junior, senior year in high school. And my senior year, my folks moved. And my sister moved to Modesto, but let me stay back and finish my senior year. And I lived at a buddy's house because I was the jazz band drummer and center snare on drumline. And like I had achieved, like I had worked myself up to some spots that
they wanted to get the payoff for all the
moved to Modesto 2 months into the school year and get bupkis, be in the band maybe kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I was living in Modesto right after high school for 6 months. And then I got the opportunity to move back up to Seattle to go to school, which at that point felt like the only way I could have just moved back up to Seattle. But I was still a kid in the kid mind of like, you got to have a kind of a reason to do stuff. And
yeah.
So I moved back up there and I went to Northwest College in Kirkland, Washington. It's an Assemblies of God school. And that is, I was religion philosophy major and I thought, a religion philosophy degree will help me be a better songwriter.
And that's actually to some degree true.
It is. It really formed the kind of songwriter that I am, which I think is more and more I realize is kind of bizarre. Like my subject or whatever is a little strange or something. Mm. And I think that how I approach it.
I was going to say, probably not your subject, more not like your angle.
Yeah, the angle on the subject. Yeah. And that I think really did flow out of that mentality of like, digging deep and trying to understand the rudiments of...
You're peeling layers back.
Peeling layers back and trying to get a look at reality.
Yeah.
But a couple years into that, my dad pulled me aside and was like, yo, man, the grades are flagging and, you maybe take a semester off and just focus on the band because the band was really active and that was in...
That was your dad's advice was to take a year off school.
Yeah.
And you should try the rock and roll thing.
See what it was like, yeah.
That's awesome.
And I thought, because he's like, you don't need a degree. I mean, there was this assumption on his part and my mom's that like that, my word that I said, I'm going to write songs and perform them for my job. They said, word. Good idea.
That's strong, man.
Yeah. And so his statement was, you don't need a degree to do what you want to do, which was assuming that it was valid what I had chosen to do. He said, why don't you just give it a shot and see what happens, And I was like, okay. Which is, as a parent now of an 11-year-old, it is a heavy, heavy thing.
Yeah, right.
That I had their support and sort of...
Well, especially to push you not towards like one safe choice or the other, but to invite you into risk.
Well, and literally I told them after I got out of high school, I was feeling the risk and I came up with this idea that I wanted to go to auto mechanic school and get a trade so that I would have like something as...
A fallback.
A fallback, yeah.
Yeah.
And they both said, don't do that. You're just, so and you're going to be an auto mechanic. Prepare for the thing that you want.
This is like nobody's story.
I know.
No one has that background.
No, it's literally the difference between me and anybody else who tried to do this that
yeah,
has
right?
the same level of talent as me.
Yeah.
You know, between that and just some over active adrenal situation, like I have the hunger and the permission and, you know, from the time I was a kid to like believe that this was a valid way to spend your life.
Yeah. And
two decades later, I'm still doing it. And so that I didn't know what it was going to look like when I was in ninth grade, I was living outside of Chico, in a town called Paradise, and I was sitting in church and I was been a drummer for 2.5 years at that point, had taken drum lessons from three different people. Cause we lived in three different towns, seventh, eighth, and ninth grade.
Yeah.
And I had seen how each of those three men cobbled a living together as musicians, teaching lessons, directing ensembles in one case, doing social work in another part-time, wedding gigs, like just how these guys had devoted their lives to this love of theirs and had figured out a way to have families and to do it. And so that was my model. Before I played guitar ever, I decided I want to be a musician for a living. And, and I was a drummer, and so I thought I'm going to give lessons. I'm going to play in jazz combos. If you get lucky, you get in a band that goes on tour and has a hot record or two for 10 years. But then everything that goes up must come back down. That was my picture of it.
That was so, back when records were hot for 5 years.
That was when, that was when the music industry was king. Like
it was.
It was its most bloated self. And, but I wasn't even thinking of it in terms of like making the NBA. That it was a very pragmatic look. It was like these guys made a living without even being in the proximity of anything like the NBA.
Yeah.
And so as an analogy for the making it in the music business, and so I just thought, so that was how I thought about music in general. And so in that sense, I'm doing exactly what I thought, which is cobbling together a living from this thing that I love. Once I started doing it, though, there was a trope that showed up, which was sort of like the Elliott Smith Built to Spill Modest Mouse trope, which is like 10 years, you know, start from nothing, be an indie band for 10 years, build up a following. Death Cab's another example.
Yep.
And then 10 years in, sign $1 million major label deal, and then just sort of be a made band for the rest of your life. And that was something that I didn't assume that I could do, but it was a goal. You know, it was definitely not a goal like I was actively pursuing it, but I thought if I keep my head down and work, that could happen.
I think it's really important to have those, to have these targets. Might be a better image. Like it's, you have these targets, but to kind of hold them loosely. Like you're going after that.
Yeah.
But if I, and did you, cause I mean, you and I both know folks who they lock in on like, this is what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
And if you're 2 degrees off that, then you feel like
you actually failed. Failure.
Yeah. But no, you actually got way down the line.
Oh yeah.
So it's so important to like, you have these targets, these things you want to achieve, but hold loosely to the particulars, like the actual landing place.
Well, and to me, the targets are to get one moving basically. And then once you're moving, you're evaluating your gait, and it's just about your process and not necessarily where you're going. I don't think so. Like, I think like, oh, here on the map, it looks like if I just run like hell in that direction for X amount of years, then I'm going to show up at this X marks a spot.
Yes.
But to me, I just think like, okay, well, so the point of that is that that gets me running in a direction.
Yep.
And then wherever I end up running to, like, I want to get good at running and I want to develop a thing where like,
which
I
ends up being really the whole point.
That's the whole point.
Because even if you have a goal and you're not a strong runner, but
you can
if you don't develop the disciplines of being an artist, then you're not going to achieve anything with it anyway.
Well, yeah, you can get to X marks a spot, but with what?
Yeah.
To what end? Like, you get there and you're just as disappointed as if you hadn't got there.
Yeah.
And so, but there's another scenario in which you don't get there and you're just as satisfied as if you, or more as if you had gotten there. And I feel like that's really a key. It's figuring out how to make a deal with yourself, you know, how to sort of like find equilibrium.
Yeah. There's a, there was a cover, a YouTuber covered the song with you.
Genesis?
Genesis. Goodness gracious. Now, like, I love that song on the record. It was when I, like, my first listen through, I was like, this is a really just like a very, it felt very, I guess for me, is like with each of your projects, sometimes there's a little bit of a, like a musical departure in one way, but there's some strands that hold things together. And that's one of the songs, like, this is a David Bazan kind of traditional song.
Yeah.
So I love the song.
Yeah. Thank you.
And cover. Somebody tweeted, and I saw this thing floating around, and I don't know if, but it sounds like you did see it.
I've retweeted it myself.
She found something in that song that was like hers, that was like for herself.
I know.
And I know it's not on the same level and the relationship's different, but it actually had the sort of like same kind of essential kind of vibe as when Cash redid Hurt.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, I didn't, like, it's the same song.
It's so
sad. And there was just
sad.
Something else that came out of that song. You've been covered a bunch by different folks.
Yeah.
Do you hear, like, when someone else does your stuff, do you hear your own stuff differently? Does it affect the way you pay attention yourself as a writer?
I don't listen to very many of them because if, God bless everybody, if somebody does, like, if somebody basically does a subpar version of a song, it affects the way I feel about the song. It makes me not like the song. It makes me not like myself.
Interesting.
And so I don't really go out of my way to watch stuff unless somebody's really insisting, like, I really, really want you to see this.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times the YouTube cover culture is such that people don't really take the most care. It's just sort of like,
they're just kind
of
doing it. They heard it two or three times.
Yeah. And so I don't, that's not for me. Like, I take enormous care and I'm on a tightrope way above the city doing my thing. And so I'm not trying to look at that stuff. Like, liking myself is a really difficult thing anyways. But occasionally one cover or two or three break through, and usually I watch everything that Genesis does because she's deadly serious.
She really is.
Well,
she was in that song.
She is not fucking around. Like, her redemption comes from her singing songs and playing drums, and the music is in her in a way that I haven't seen it in a lot of folks. So I everything that Genesis does, I get to it eventually, because she's remarkable.
So there was something even for there was something really galvanizing for that, like for you in
I cried. Yeah.
It's
every time I will if I when I watch it, because it's just it's vulnerable. She's taking an enormous risk.
Yeah,
you know. With it. And the other one is Never Wanted You. There's a cover of it by a band called Mint Julep that is better than any version that I've done and makes the song. It was the first time that I realized, like, oh, this is a fantastic song. Like, you wrote a fucking brilliant song, and I don't think that about my music, but hearing it
from someone else reinterpreted your stuff.
They reinterpreted it, and production wise, just like destroyed the like the transitions are so. Yeah. And it's a female singer, so it's even more removed from this.
Well,
like,
and in both cases, so the voice ends up being
it helps,
something you can hear as you.
It helps give me some distance because I really am learning to like myself, kind of in real time. This summer, this month, it's been the big project.
Interesting.
And
does that, like, in that process, that comes with other people's perception to some degree?
For me, It doesn't. What it the degree that it does is that I have to accept the positive things that people feel about me.
Yeah.
That I've known that they're there, but I've not been able to believe them. They haven't seemed believable to me. And then there was the realization that, like, this is a switch that until you flip it, you're just going to be stuck in this thing that you don't,
yeah,
you don't want to be here. You're right. Trying to get out of it. And so I decided I needed to flip the switch, and it seemed like, well, that might be the dreaded kind of fake it till you feel it kind of thing, where you just flip the switch and, you know, see if it sticks kind of thing. And it, so in that sense, there's a couple of people in my life that when I see myself through their eyes, I can like myself.
Yeah.
And that's really redemptive, and really just, you know, a lot of grace comes through that.
Yeah. Having a large audience make that more difficult because so many people are perceiving you?
Having a large audience, it just feels coincidental. It doesn't feel it doesn't feel meaningful.
It seems pretty intentional. I mean, you're saying it's coincidental, but like, I mean,
it's coincidental that it doesn't mean that I am valuable or not valuable.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, cause when Control was happening and Pedro was bigger than we've ever been, I was the least satisfied I've ever been. You know what I mean? Because I hadn't unlocked my combination.
Yeah. Okay.
I feel like I have to unlock me and understand how to work that thing at will.
Yeah.
Be able to walk up to the locker and unlock it and lock it back at it. You know what I mean? Like figure it out.
Yeah.
And then once that happens, it's almost like having a huge audience. It's like getting to the X marks the spot without having figured out yourself.
Yeah, right.
It's like, congratulations, you have a huge audience and you're still empty and lonely.
Yeah.
And the difference being is if you show up there and you've figured out your combination, you don't feel empty and lonely.
And now you have something really particular and a little bit more powerful to offer.
Yeah. And if I don't end up with a large audience, but I unlock my combination. And this is what we were talking about as we were coming in, that's what you try to tell people to do. Look, it's not about the audience.
Yeah.
That's not the point. It doesn't matter. You're trying to unlock your combination lock.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to figure out how to find equilibrium and peace in the valley and a creative output that honors what's going on in your subconscious and honors the people around you and all these things. And if you get a huge audience without achieving that, fuck you. I mean, you're going to be just so empty. So that's what I mean, that the audience is coincidental. It's just like either they're going to come or they don't, but that's not the litmus test for if I've been successful. It's internal. It's you know, man against himself kind of thing. And so, but that said, there is a lot of data coming from that big group of people that when it's, that is corroborated in people who I know and I can believe when they say,
like, you need that data verified by folks you trust.
Yeah, because strangers, you just don't know. It's the same thing. Somebody says, oh, you're awful. It's just like, okay, I'm going to assume that you're awful and that's why you're saying that. Yes. And so I can walk away and not feel shitty. And I feel like you got to do the same thing with the other thing. Oh, you're great. And you just got to leave it. You know, Chappelle says, if you pick it up, you got to put it back down at some point.
Yeah, agreed.
And so you just leave it there and do your work and know, like, that it's not like you have to disregard it totally.
You just can't own it.
You can't let it into your house. You can't let it into your space where you're doing the thing. It's sort of that, it's a loose, you know, peripheral kind of gauge of,
yeah.
But at the same time, Van Gogh, you know, no, it's not. It's not a gauge of anything necessarily, because sometimes it takes forever to catch up.
Yeah.
So I don't want people to think like, oh, because people aren't responding. I feel like I've unlocked my combination. People aren't responding. What does that mean?
Yeah.
It means you're Van Gogh.
Hmm.
You know? And why not just live with it? That's cool. That would be dope. I mean, don't let it turn you into a dick.
Yeah.
But just understand, like, I got to unlock my combination. That's it. That's all I can do, you know? And if people don't get it, if it's somehow wrong for the culture right now, if it's somehow the wrong message, it's either prophetic or I'm just straight wrong. And that's fine. And I don't need to know. I just need to unlock my combination. That's it.
Reading a book by Kevin Kelly.
Kevin Kelly. I know that name.
Kevin Kelly was one of the guys behind Wired magazine.
Oh, right, right, right.
Yeah. Phenomenal writer, great guy. And it's a book called Inevitable, or The Inevitable.
The Inevitable.
It's about ultimately technology, our use of it, how it affects our lives, and part of what it gets after. And in this context, for you, when he talks about technology, specifically the technologies that you use to create and distribute and sell music.
Yep.
He writes this, and I just want to get your thoughts about it. Over time, if a technology persists long enough, it costs... Let me start from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, if a technology persists long enough, its costs begin to approach but never reach zero.
Mm-hmm.
In the goodness of time, any particular technological function will act as if it were free. The slide towards the free seems to be true for basic things like foodstuffs and materials, and complicated stuff like appliances, as well as services and tangibles. This is the point. The costs of all these per fixed unit has been dropping over time, particularly since the Industrial Revolution. According to 2002 paper, blah, 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 there has been a downward trend in real commodity prices of about 1% per year over the last 140 years.
Good Lord.
For a century and a half, prices have headed towards zero. So for you, this trend technologically is what musicians find themselves caught in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go from CDs to iTunes through the Napster thing to Spotify. How are you, like, functionally, maybe emotionally, how are you navigating that? In terms of distribution, in terms of your relationship with an audience, as things move towards free, as things the value for the actual technology, for the item of distribution, as that becomes freer or towards free, how are you navigating that? I mean, in terms of making a living, like, what's that look like for you?
Well, it's, you know, if you look at just how the work has changed, certainly since 2004 or 5, when the real slide in terms of sales, album sales, started changing. You know, I tour way more. So, and to me, that's a picture of the thing that is helpful, because it's not the touring, but it's the real sort of immutable aspect of it. Hmm. As the industry and as practitioners of this sort of vocation kind of get less and less real, or as the business model and like the way that people engage in the thing gets more and more kind of speculative, and sort of like the way that advertising works in terms of income and stuff like that, where it's not direct, it's indirect.
Mm-hmm.
That I more and more value a very direct, not barter system, but where it's like I'm trading something that you want right now for money.
More of a direct relationship with your audience.
A direct relationship, which is what it was through distributors for years. It was a physical.
Yeah.
I'm trying to sort of play up, not like physical in terms of vinyl, which, but that is a component of it.
Yeah.
Because I am a consumer of music through iTunes. I travel half the year, and so I don't bring records everywhere I go. I've got, you know, iTunes Match or whatever. And so I understand, mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't, it's the same as my Walkman to me when I was a kid. Mm. Like it's, I have to cultivate a relationship with it because the Walkman obviously has some perks, limitations, and things that make you tune into it a little bit more. But that's right. how I feel about, so that to say, I understand digital and I understand that stuff, but in general, I want this thing to be more real than it was previously, the thing that I'm doing, where I show up, and house shows are a part of that, where there's just a thing where you can't get that experience another place. You sold yourself a trope, but then the dollar broke. Hello again, oblivion, but it's no good to complain.
Those house shows are easy to book. To some degree, because you have,
we control the entire process.
Well, more to the point, for me, I'm thinking like, I want to call it unique. It's not entirely unique, but you have a relatively unique relationship with your audience,
right?
Like, not every artist or band has that kind of, and people call it tribal, you know, relation. Do you feel that, like, when you pay attention to what's going on with you and your folks, do you note that, like, there's a distinctive, but in terms of like who you are in relationship to your audience and what other bands and artists have experienced?
What I've perceived is that because I'm a little seat of the pants, we've asked my fans to extend trust in a way that is unusual in a commercial relationship.
Okay. How so functionally? Do you mean?
Strange negotiations. We just said, hey, basically buy this record before I make it. Pre-order the record before it's done so that I have the ability to stay home and make the record.
Yeah.
And we'll turn it in by this time and you'll get it in this amount of time.
Why do you think they trust you like that?
Well, because because I'm seat of the pants, and because we end up in situations where the only way to move forward is to sort of extend that request.
Yeah.
In that case, for instance, and there are other sort of small ways in which I believe that happened previous. We always, it's kind of novel, the house show. By then, we'd been doing house shows. That's
right.
So the house show is saying, in this zip code, we're going to play a show on this date.
Right.
That's all the information you're getting. Do you want to pay $25 to come see a show in a place where you don't know right now before you buy where it is and you've never been there? And we promise that as soon as you click this button and give us your money, we're going to give you the information that you need to get to the house show. That is a huge risk.
Yeah.
That is abnormal in commercial relationships. But your
folks take that risk.
They take the risk, and they've taken it. So 600 shows times 50 heads. I mean, they've taken it that many times.
Yeah.
So it's like this small little trust falls in our relationship because we have, that was, I mean, so the reason why I pioneered this logistical method of doing house shows in a way that other people haven't is because that little trick, that risk where we tell people to do something abnormal in a commercial relationship, I am just Forrest Gump enough to think like, yeah, like I do honor system merch. Yeah. Like I just want to trust.
You're setting people up to engage with you in a relationship.
And to that, take that risk.
And if there isn't risk,
right,
then that relationship doesn't actually,
it's not a relationship.
Deepen. Yeah.
You know, if there's no risk, it's not really a relationship.
Yeah.
It's something else.
So you're giving your audience a way to actually have like risk and share the burden of what you are trying to do as an artist.
Well, and because it's a magic trick, when you put up an honor system merch bin at a house show and people walk up to it, and they look at it and they read all the stuff and they're just like, it takes your breath away.
Yeah.
In modern society, to have, there's, so honor system merch, there's a little cavity in this wood box that I've made that's just full of money.
Yeah.
And it says, take what you want, pay your money, make change for yourself. Yeah. Reach into the thing, touch the money, make change.
Yeah.
And then you do that and you walk away, 10, 15, 20 people in a night might do that. And 10, 15, 20 people have an experience that they may not have had in their entire life, where somebody has left their money out and said, I trust you, even though we've never met, and I might never meet you.
Yeah.
So to me, those are things, those little things take our breath away.
Yeah.
And there are these little magic tricks that you just go, well, fuck.
Yeah.
That is so, it warms you. It's just like old timey in a way that you want it to be.
That's a good word.
And so there's a ton of those that are built into every aspect. I want the house shows themselves are that. When we thought of the house show idea, we came up to the point where we thought, this is great. This is going to work. We're so excited. It's like this frenzy.
Yeah.
And then one of us goes, dude, whoa, whoa, whoa. 40 strangers that we don't know, we're saying to another stranger, would you have all these people in your house? I think they're probably nice people because they seem like it at all my other shows. That's what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so even that's why no one else had done that, because Bob and I are just like simple enough where we said, you know what? I think this will work. People can hang with this. It's an idealistic thing that we're doing.
That responsibility we talked about earlier, which that I would suggest an audience, if someone is a listener of yours, like they do have towards you. Like there's a responsibility in that relationship.
Yeah.
You're providing actual spaces for them to take that responsibility.
Yeah.
I mean, this is part of life. Like folks are always mind blown, not always, but often mind blown with their crowdfunding results.
Right.
Because finally an audience
people want to participate.
Has a way to share in that and actually manifest their responsibility.
Can you imagine if every time you went to the record store to buy a record, that you got your name added to this internet list of people that you could that you knew was out there that said that you bought this record? That's so it takes the anonymity out of supporting. Yeah. Artists, those crowdfunding things.
You get to kind of claim your place in the tribe.
And to feel some, it's funny. I've been really reticent. That I've been trying to understand the crowdfunding thing. And I feel like I haven't, there's been something about it that I haven't been able to wrap my mind around. And there was just a little bit of movement just then in my thing.
Because you haven't done a traditional, you haven't done a Kickstarter.
No, I haven't. We've basically done glorified pre-sales of the records and then overpriced.
But you haven't used like a platform and you've overpriced t-shirts.
Overpriced t-shirts. Yeah. But the overpriced t-shirt that I'm talking about was $20, which is still cheaper than a Wilco shirt. Yeah. Or whatever. Any band.
What are you selling your shirts for, like $12, $15?
$20 now. Now it's I when I realized like welcome overpriced to, t-shirts. Welcome to the 90s. I know exactly. Right. Are $20 in my mind, and everybody else is willing to pay $30 at the fucking national show.
It would still freak me out if I'm selling shirts at $20. I'd be like, God, that's a lot of money for a shirt.
It is. But then you look at
but people want
with
to
American
spend that
apparel,
money.
Like we really are paying, $9 a shirt in some cases. And so trying to, putting on that businessman hat and not just going with sort of like the standard indie rock pricing for everything, but really looking at it and seeing what is the value of this for me? What is our cost? Like how to manufacture, like how to come to all those conclusions, and then realizing like, so Ian MacKay, my hero, still refuses to play shows for over $10. We're getting ready to bump the house shows up to $30.
Yeah.
How do I feel about this? What is my ethic about these things? What am I comfortable with? Most of our ethics about that stuff are reactive to perception.
Yes.
People wouldn't have their songs in commercials for years because of how it was perceived.
Yeah.
Now nobody cares, and so everybody does it. That's fucking weak.
Huh.
You know what I mean? Not that people put their songs in commercials, but the reason that we do or don't do a thing is because of perception.
Yeah.
That's not ethics.
No.
That's conformity.
It's reactionary. Yeah. It's absolutely conformity. Yes.
And so I just think, I don't know. I lost my train of thought a little bit. But
that's right.
Surrounded by all my love.
One of our other podcast guests, a guy named Busby, he writes songs for like pop stars.
Word. Okay, different.
So guy. Like Kelly Clarkson and
Word.
Keith Urban, this guy. Yeah. And he talks about specifically as a pop songwriter, because that's his job. That in art we talk about the fear of failure, and the fear of failure keeps you from doing things. But then we talk about the kind of this fear of success, because he will have had this remarkable success of a song, and then wonder about the next thing. Like once you've reached that moment. So as an example, he wrote this one of his first major hits. He wrote the song "Try."
Yeah.
The Pink song "Try."
Oh shit, yeah.
It's a great song, right?
Totally.
And then like he's at that peak, and he's looking on the other side of the mountain and wondering like, is that it? Am I done?
Yeah.
Like, is this as good as it gets? I'm wondering if you've kind of lived in that space. I mean, you talked about the album, you talked about the Control album as an example.
Yeah.
Like I'm just imagining, and I could be dead wrong here, but I'm imagining like standing like at that point. And looking at that, like the tribal response to that record, because even was it 2 or 3 years ago?
Yeah, 2012.
You retoured,
and that was the most successful Bazan tour by far. I mean, it was a really clear indication that brand name and that record
really hit.
Are something that people respond to.
Does it come with? Is there an anxiety that comes with that to like hit something, or do you not? Do you just kind of hit something and you move on? You drop it, and it is what it is, and you're on to the next thing.
Yeah, on to the next thing. I mean, for me, the way that I felt about the Control tour is that I hoped that it could achieve something real every night, because the possibility that it's just a reference to something in the past only, or sort of like doing karaoke of a thing, is really real. I mean, it's the way that most of those things tend to go.
Yeah.
And I just am so not interested in that. So that was the trepidation that I felt. So I felt really grateful at moments. I'm picturing the moment at the Neptune at the end of the tour, and where I just thought, this is for real right now. Like we're inhabiting these tunes in a way that is not about the past at all. It's about what's happening right now. And so I guess I'm just really grateful when I can find that, because I'm like the dick in art school who like just like, we can't do this because it's the same as the thing before, you know, like, and I'm not saying that out loud. I just have this, I'm just pushing.
So in other words, like you're actually seeing, I think it was communicating, you're seeing your work, like your body of work rather than the individual work. There's a body of work you're putting together.
Yeah,
the Controls as one record, Branches as one record. And there's moments in this longer process. And great, this is a bigger moment, but it's a moment among many.
And reputation is worthless to me. Like if this coffee shop that I'm about to pay $4 for this cup of coffee has the best reputation in town, and yet I can pay $4 three times in a row and not get a transcendent cup of coffee, who fucking cares about the reputation?
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about myself. It causes me to be really hard on myself and a little bit judgmental, but I can remove, I'm learning how to remove the judgment from it and still have that ethic. That the idea is that you do the thing now. You do the thing now. That you could do it in the past is the reason why people are there. But the reason why they're there is for you to do something
now. So to have had a success gives you kind of permission to believe like, if I did that then,
I can do it again. I can do something new now.
And I think that is rare, unfortunately rare among artists.
Well,
because there is oftentimes that sort of that more so like I hit this thing, it went really well. I don't know if I can do that again. That tends to be more
And every record, like every singer, songwriter, every artist or whatever, I just thought, I don't think I can write songs again. You know, for 10 records in a row, I felt that.
Huh.
Where you get done with the record and you just think, how's this going to work? And it's sort of like, you know, Moses in the desert. It's just like, you lack faith, you learn the lesson. You lack faith, you learn the lesson. How long did it take for those guys to learn that lesson?
Right.
Rolling around in the desert before they got into the promised land. So I just feel like, you've got to look at the data and let that data get you to the precipice, and then bridge it with faith every time. Yeah. Just know like it always feels crazy and like I can never do it again, but I've never not done it. So at some point, I just have faith that this is how it works. And then I can interact with that insecurity in a way that's now a part of the process and not an inhibitor. Man, it's funny. I realized like one of the things that the Bible and the Christian tradition did for me more than anything else is that way of interacting with counterintuitive data.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That the story of Moses and the Israelites in the desert for all that time.
Kind of like almost like a wise, responsible believing against perception.
Yeah, that there's perception and then there's reality that sort of underlies that it can be a little bit misleading or the relationship can be a little mysterious and confusing. And to really try to look at those deeper dynamics and to learn those lessons. I just remember over and over again thinking like Moses, like hearing those stories as a kid being like, when are you going to wake up, buddy? Like, when are you going to come, you know, learn your lesson, basically? When are you going to listen to the deeper things happening here? And that's still the lesson.
Yeah, and then you find yourself in that place and realize it's actually harder to believe that.
It's really hard.
To believe that this is going to work out.
But to know that lesson and to see how difficult it is. I mean, that's the thing. That's the beauty of that story is it is a difficult dynamic and it's presented as such. It seems impossible. You know what I mean? Like he's so thick-headed. He so fundamentally misunderstands the power that he possesses,
right,
that he has access to in this myth or reality. Either way, it's just really not the point. And for my mind.
Yeah.
And so to understand that and to know like, yeah, it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel crazy.
Yeah.
When you strike this balance, when you step into this, it's like standing in the ocean. I mean, it's like being in a cage with a wild animal when you're in the thing, you're doing it. It's like, it's scary.
Yeah.
You know, you have all of a sudden your hands are on the controls and you can really make or break a thing.
Yeah. And it's the breaking that's actually terrifying.
Yeah. Like, but you do, you break it over and over again and then you rebuild it. And it's that kintsugi notion where, you know, show your work, man. Yeah. That's the other thing, that people don't want to look like a fool. You do. You can't help it. You got to get cool with that.
And you look more a fool if you're trying not to.
Oh, yeah. We see it over and over again. Washed up people trying to put that same posture on.
Yeah.
Fuck, man. It's so embarrassing. And so that's what keeps you from like, I would rather be a fool
in the process,
having found my combination in the wilderness with nobody listening to me, than to be delusional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Way rather that.
On the tune, or on the same wavelength as talking about journey and foolishness, I don't know if you know Madeline L'Engle's stuff at all, but
reading *Wrinkle in Time*. My daughter and I right now.
So good.
Yeah,
there's a graphic novel version of that book. Are you a graphic novel guy?
Well, sure. I mean, not all the way, but yes.
Okay, there's a graphic novel, and I don't remember who the author is. Yeah. It is. So sometimes like you take the novel and you make it graphic and it kind of loses a bit.
Oh man, because she's into comics crazy and
she would love it.
She's struggling a little bit with it in the middle here. But yeah, so that'll
it's really super pop. Good. Regardless, so L'Engle writes about the sort of this I guess ethic or sort of root of art making. It's a book called Walking on Water. And there are these two quotes from the book that I'm going to sort of poke you with and
please
see what comes out. The discipline of creation, be it to paint, compose, or write, is an effort toward wholeness. That's the first part of the quote. Mm-hmm. Then it goes on to say, the great artists have gained their wholeness through their wounds.
Yeah.
That seems so definitive, or descriptive, I should say, of your process.
Yeah.
because we talk about, you know, like the willingness to look foolish.
Yeah.
Specifically, this newer record,
mm-hmm.
like you've never shied away from darker themes, sure. and difficulty and strife. And you've never, it's not that you've been like averse to personal struggle.
Mm-hmm.
This record seems to get deeper into your own skin
mm-hmm.
than previous times. I mean, you've had these, you know, these really personal moments like on Branches and the conversation with your daughter at right. the end, but that's still kind of this
right.
like theological thing that's happening. This record feels like you're sort of in, like as a listener, you're yeah. sort of
in
this really wavy kind of unsettled psychological moment in your history.
Yep.
Do you feel like what you're, is there, when you're talking, let's combine that with the notion that you see what you're doing as a kind of a larger body of work as opposed to one moment and one moment. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's a progression? Like you're on a, do you feel like there's a journey? And is it toward wholeness? Like do you feel
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Branches, you know, I didn't want to write Branches. I didn't want to write a record about those things at right. that moment. That was my chance to sort of redefine myself, you yes. know, to kind of recast myself. It was the first solo full length. I thought that Fewer Moving Parts was a subtle evolution from Pedro in a way that hinted at this other place that it could go.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to write in slightly more obtuse ways. You know, I the expressions of folks like Britt Daniel and these guys who somehow their heart is clearly in it, but it's mysterious. And mm-hmm. and I wanted a little bit of mystery, I think, because I felt at the time like I had been pretty unmysterious. And so that was the backdrop. And then these songs started coming that were the songs from Branches. And I was like, oh, well, here's this one outlier. Like, I'll use this for something. But I was almost like trying to write a record separately. And then the songs from Branches were kind of piling up and I was playing them live. And the whole time, like for the first little bit, thinking like, is this going to be an EP? Yeah. I don't want to make a record about this, you know, kind of thing. And then when I would play these house shows, as I was writing these songs and bringing them to these house shows, two things were happening. One, I would hit the downbeat of the song to start playing. And then almost in the blink of an eye, I'd hit the downbeat to end it. And they would go by so fast, you know?
Huh.
Like I would hit
you're
it.
Really, really connected.
I was
to
connect.
Songs.
I was inhabiting them completely.
Yeah.
Without knowing that was what was happening, and then people were like gasping at some of those songs have like punchlines.
Yeah.
Little moments, and I would drop those punchlines in these house show situations, which were still pretty new at the point for them and me. So it's like really rarefied air in a way, like we're all just looking at this thing like what's going on, and then I'm singing these songs that are pretty vulnerable in that context, but they're about this bigger thing that we're all sort of
right.
really haunted by, like a lot of us who are at mm-hmm. these shows, you yeah. know. Not every Pedro fan is a or Pedro or Bazan fan is a Christian or a former Christian, but there is an abnormally large percentage of
yeah.
especially the former Christians.
Which is part of the uniqueness of your audience and part of what I'm going after in terms of like this journey you've been on.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're all experiencing, and I, in a way I'm experiencing these songs for the first, second, third, fourth time too.
Mm-hmm.
So they're new to me and these ideas that, you know, are new. And so people are gasping at these punchlines and
yeah.
laughing in a really uncomfortable way. And it's like these really provocative and yeah. sort of like tense and stirring kind of shows. And so in the end of that, I just had to admit like, well, dude, your body is doing something and you just yeah. need to like listen to
give
it.
Into that.
So I did, and I thought that I had processed my kind of whatever you would call it, my break from the Christian tradition, the way that I had participated in it previously.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't, and I needed to write those tunes and play them each 200 times before that work was really done, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was humbling because you really think that you're in control or you can sort of, that in normal human terms, you can sort of process stuff. But like these songs are you know, for the subject matter, they're relatively potent. They're heavy tunes. And I played them each so many times. And yeah. it really was, I really needed all of each little drip of water from, or of, you know, renewal from those things and therapy. I needed all of it. And so, you know, Strange Negotiations. So now I start to think of everything as like, yeah, I'm getting more whole for sure. And there
and
also,
you started sensing that process with the Branches.
Oh, record. Yeah, yeah, clearly.
Way, way more conscious about it. Like, you, that may have been happening in the Pedro years and to some degree with, yeah. in a, with the first EP, mm-hmm. but then...
Well, in the form that it takes is that, like, so when I write a song like When We Fell, where it's, I'm talking directly to, you know, on the surface, I'm talking directly to Jehovah, evangelical, specifically probably Reformed Church Jehovah mm-hmm. in the song, which in the context of our culture is not a proxy for the real thing. That is what we perceive as the real thing.
Yeah. Or the perceived reality.
The perceived of reality of God. So I'm writing this song at the perceived reality of God, which is the starting point, and it's scary. You know, there are still voices in my head when I'm writing When We Fell that are saying, lightning, watch out. Like, if you get struck by lightning as you're driving down the street, as this lyric is forming in your head, you won't be surprised.
Right.
You know, because I have these voices. I mean, there's all of these different perspectives that are still being represented.
Yeah.
So I'm writing about the perceived reality, which in Christianity is synonymous with the reality. There's no distinction between those two things in Christians' minds, in my experience, and there wasn't in my mind. And so part of the journey with a song like that, and as a microcosm of the whole record, I start to realize that I'm talking to the Wizard of Oz in some way. Yes. Or maybe it's not the Wizard of Oz. Maybe it's just, oh my God, I'm speaking to institutional thinking.
Yes,
I'm speaking to a character that we have... this fictional character that might bear some resemblance to reality, but if it does or doesn't, that's not the point for this culture. And that hasn't been the point for me. And so starting to realize, but these songs, my subconscious sort of like craft, my criteria for them was unknown to me, but they came out in such a way that even as these shifts of perception of what the subject even is in the song is happening, the song still works. The perception of the subject morphs into some middle ground. Song still works. It now I know I see it for the facade that it was totally
the subject.
It was always the subject.
Yeah,
the song still works. And so somehow, for me, that was the weird staying power of that record is that I could sing those songs, and as they morphed in my head, they were changing. So it wasn't. It felt new all the time. Like my. It was actually making those little gradual shifts in my brain and kind of unhooking me from the real delusion that I participated in with Christianity. Not that Christianity is a delusion, but there is, as we...
Much delusion within.
Digging up the root of my confusion. If no one planted it, how does it?
Parsing of perceived reality versus actual fundamental reality, like there's a great deal of Christian tradition that kind of falls into that space. That's part of the tradition. You know, the prophetic tradition is always kind of a parsing between this is what you believe and think, and then here's the fundamental reality. And I've heard it discussed that even now, I don't know if I'm going to say even now, but like that you have in the past and still do play that role. Even in the context of, even in a religious context, that for a lot of listeners who still hold to maybe some of the fundamental theological truths of the Christian tradition, they still depend on your voice to help parse
some
the facade or the, mm-hmm. the perceived reality from. Do you see yourself in that role? Do you accept that role? Mm-hmm. Do you feel a responsibility in that?
So my transition, and one of the things that Branches really helped with was, you know, right after you make a kind of a shift like I made in 2005, roughly, is when sort of the big break happened, where the system of belief just kind of, you know, fell apart. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of defensiveness that is really natural right after that, mm-hmm. you know?
In you?
In one, yeah, in me. And it certainly seemed like that was a natural thing. Like there's a trauma and a woundedness from all of these sort of experiences that you're having, that part of you is like, you need to like sort of steal away and get whole and kind of protect yourself. But at the same time, you're leaving this thing and everybody is feeling really defensive about you leaving.
Hmm.
And they're kind of, you know, everybody wants to understand why. And especially in that culture, you know, you really should have a reason, a proof text, hopefully. You know, and
I love that. I love little proof text.
But that was my feeling.
Yeah,
you know, like a modernist sort of reason for this thing.
And it's like this inception moment. You need a proof text for you're divorcing yourself from the culture of the proof texting.
Yeah. And so it was real. You know, it's really it was really painful. And so there's a defensiveness that's just natural when your mm-hmm. nerves are just like experiencing pain. And so, but as that just dissipates over time, and especially if you're getting some sort of catharsis and therapy as you're going through it. And for me, it was just Branches. Like I wrote this record I was unclenching slowly, and so when people would hit me with challenges and questions, I wouldn't have to modulate my affect to stay chill, you know, any longer. Like
because it was personal, and you
because
were
just... I was moving, I was unclenching. You know, initially when somebody would sort of poke at me, like it hurt, you know, and I kind of would react, and I would try to react kindly,
yeah,
but I didn't feel kind. I felt like fight or flight. It felt harsh. It felt dangerous, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But as that lessened, as I was doing this therapy, I just started to realize more and more, and with the help of really close friends like David Dark and people like this who are coming from the perspective of Christianity in a broad sense,
yeah,
but are really representing none of the delusions as far as I can see.
Yeah. He's pretty great.
Yeah, and so just these helpful things and him sort of corroborating little inklings that I had, which was that the idea that I'm now stepping outside of the Christian tradition by writing a record called Branches, or by saying any of the things, or coming to any of the conclusions that I came to about Christianity, mm-hmm. is so asinine and historically unfounded. That I'm stepping outside of the Christian tradition is just, it's a feature of this post-Darwin, culture war, post-Reagan, post-Lee Atwater, evangelical American Christianity. I am stepping outside of that very narrow tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what I was doing. Yeah. But am I, Dave Bazan, still playing in the Christian tradition in a broader sense? Come on. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is yes. Do I write about God? Do I write about the application of scripture to culture? Do I write about the difference that always has existed between the prophetic and the practice of Christian faith? Yes. Every song, every record.
Yeah.
And so you
had to come to a place of comfort with that.
Yeah, realizing that no matter what anybody else said, that because the tradition that I was a part of the most was the evangelical tradition. That's my home. It's not Catholicism.
Right.
So when there are evangelical voices saying, "Oh, he's," I've even had friends say, like I would talk about the Bible, and they'd say, "I don't really think you get to talk to me about the Bible." And it was just like,
it's just unreal, man.
You're fucking insane. What are you talking? I have no credit. Yeah. You know what I know about the Bible.
Yeah.
You know my perspective about it. Is it really invalid because I'm on the other side of this political line. It's it's a human line. It's not an ancient
line.
If
there's a line.
If there's a line, to whatever degree there's a cultural line, it's man-made and it is not ancient. Acts 29 is the biggest delusion that has ever existed. The idea that anybody in the modern context is somehow the very next chapter or just sort of like directly the next thing in line from the early church
right.
is so crazy because culturally we have no sense of the differences there or what made that thing work. I mean, there's communism in it. I mean, there's just all this stuff that is just so missing from our understanding of that time and those people and what was driving them. And I joked, you know, if any of those people showed up in our church today, we would ask them to leave because they would be wearing things that indicated that they were terrorists, you know? And so it's just so funny to me that you get an Acts 29 convention of people and all those same people, if any of the apostles were there, would feel deeply uncomfortable and scared for their lives, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the idea that they wave this flag without any understanding of the deep, deep divide between their view of themselves and the world and their place in the world and privilege and all these other things, and that they're a direct descendant of any ancient thing is just so, it's just so insane.
Yeah.
It's so myopic and
which is part of you parsing perceived realities versus like maybe more foundational fundamental realities.
Yeah.
You don't feel the same way that is often communicated of you,
mm-hmm.
this sort of like departure or stepping out.
Yep.
Those words don't connect emotionally with you, what you believe or feel like is a place for you in a broader cultural context.
Well, that's evolved, you know, over time, because like I said, at the beginning, I didn't feel like I had any place in any of it. I felt like I had deliberately extricated myself from it. But then you just realize like, no, I'm still in it. I'm still surrounded by it. I still care. Anytime I'm listening to the news and something comes up about something having to do with evangelicals, I turn it up. I care what happens. Mm-hmm. Before I die, I want to see movement in the evangelical church. I'd love to see a glimpse of the wheels turning.
And because it's still family for you.
It's family and the ideals. I mean, when you really get down with that document, there are ways to interpret that document where the fruit is good.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not happened that commonly. But I think I really believe it can, you know, and I'm not a believer. I don't believe in the resurrection. I don't believe in the fall. I don't believe in the Trinity. I don't know if there is a God at all, but I know that document pretty well. Mm-hmm. And I see a thread in it that one could follow and the fruit of one's life and one's community and everything would be something really different than what we see in America. And what, I mean, God damn it, the poison that is just sort of seeping up through and coming to the surface now. If there's any question that we've been doing Christianity fundamentally wrong in the United States for our entire history, I don't think that if there ever was, there just can't be now.
It's the broad acceptance of Donald Trump as a
political
representative of anything remotely like Christianity.
In the face of this cry from the marginalized minority black population that, again, you guys, it isn't fixed yet.
Yeah.
You're still doing it.
Yeah.
And the response from Christianity is Donald Trump in enough numbers that it's a threat. It's pure sadness. I mean, it's just, and so that's not to say, I mean, and people say, well, the church is always going to be imperfect, man. It's just like, okay, the whole perfect, imperfect thing that Christians are obsessed with. I'm not perfect. I never said I was perfect. It's just like, be fucking functional. You know, pick a fucking kingdom at least.
Yeah.
That's all you got to do. If you're a Christian, be a Christian. Oh, you're also a capitalist? Harmonize those things for me and I'll be psyched. You can. I believe it. I'm not saying you can't.
But do the work.
But you have to work harder than you're working because you are not doing it. You're so upside down right now. You know, the church is so, it's still so upside down. And, you know, and I love the work that Barna and you know, Kinnaman and Gabe and these guys are doing, but it still is in the window dressing phases. They're collecting the data that can get us to the next phase, but the analysis is not yet there.
Well, and the actionables are so threatening.
They are, because you have to move to inerrancy. You have to move to a deeper respect of the Bible for any of this to change. And there are big, big ones like that, that unless those things flip and we start to perceive reality rather than what we want to bring to that document. And so those are the big things that have to change. When you go, you see the proposals that are being made, and they are just saying basically chill out and adjust your attitudes. But the fundamental doctrinal basis of the thing, there isn't a real call for change in that way. And as I'm zooming out and looking like, look, the Bible's not inerrant. So if everybody in church actually thinks that it is, how much better would we do if everybody just realized, like, this isn't meant to harmonize in the way that you believe that it is. Mm. It does harmonize, but not like a math problem.
Right.
You know, it harmonizes like a song or a symphony or something much more complex than we're treating it as. Mm-hmm. You know, and until the Kinnamans and the Lions of the, you know, are, will lead and say, can't make a claim about heaven and hell. Can't make a claim about universalism, not universalism. We can make a claim about love. We can make a claim about grace. We can make claims about faith. Can't make claims about truth, rightness, wrongness. That's not the role of faith. That's not the role of grace in culture, you know? Hmm. To be a salve. Could the church be a salve? Could the church... You know, the Jehovah's Witness, everybody thinks they're crazy. They don't have a horse in the political race. They believe the Bible in a different and I think idolatrous way, but the fruit on their tree is better than evangelical Christianity in terms of unity, in terms of harmony. Everybody thinks they're fucking crazy. And I'm not saying become Jehovah's Witness, but just look at how it could be. Hmm. Could we be a salve to one another? Could we listen and be challenged in our politics to somebody else's perspective and know that the right answer, the conclusion, crunching the data, that's not the point of this conversation. Mm-hmm. The point of this conversation is my friend is hurting and he needs to express it. And the way that he's hurting, the way that it comes out is he is saying that Donald Trump is great. And I'm going to listen to him and not argue with him and just hear him because he needs to say all this stuff. Mm. And in modernist Christianity, we can't exist. We have to say, yeah, I hear you, but, or like you talk about gay shit or whatever. It's just like, okay, I hear where you're coming from, but I just got to say that like, love the sin or hate the sin, you know, kind of thing. Like you have to
I'm coming with my point. And I'm not coming in relationship.
In relationship and just being like, and you can say your point too, but not in the sense of like trying to convince, just like I have hurt in here that I need to get out, you know, and you're my friend. And so that's what we do for each other.
Yeah.
And we sit like monkeys and we pick the stuff off each other. And when I realize that you have a blind spot, then I come close to you and I pick at your blind spot and I say, hey man, you got a blind spot.
Yeah. It's always struck me that whole notion of the teaching of the plank and the speck.
Oh yeah.
That in order to see a speck in someone's eye, you've got to be pretty damn close.
You got to be close.
Yeah. You have to be really close to someone actually to see that speck. Which communicates, like, in order to do that kind of work, there's an intimacy.
The intimacy.
Which makes the whole plank part of it really fascinating. Like, if you, like, there's a plank in your eye and that doesn't allow you to have the proximity to make the judgment about someone else's speck.
And to the degree that, you know, if it's not just this binary between the small and the very small and the very big, but this sort of continuum. Like, you know, you might be in a situation, this is how it works, where somebody comes to you and they've got like a medium-sized thing in their eye and they can come close enough to see the speck in your eye and graciously not seeing the thing in their eye, they say, hey man, you got a speck in your eye. And you go, you see the thing in their eye.
And you just say,
thanks,
man.
Go ad hominem and you go, oh man, I do, I see it. Can you help me with that?
Yeah.
Can you help me get it out? And then you do the weird sort of like cowardly, you know, the lion with the thing in their, the splinter in their paw thing where it's just like, right. Once you see it in there, it's not easy to get it out.
Yeah.
But then the whole time you're doing this process, somebody who has whatever, extremely bad breath. I mean, that's not the thing, but like some uncomfortable, they're close and you're repulsed by the thing that's going on with them, but they're bringing you the good, helpful information. And I don't know, there's just, we could be a salve. You know, and I think, and the point of all this,
if we weren't trying to make a point all the time, we could be a salve.
And the thing why I think that Christianity is because of my heart is still locked up in aspects of the culture of it and the tradition of it, why it's not a lost cause to me is I think that you can, I see it, you know, I see, you can interpret that document, you can love it, you can live in it, you can live in the culture and come to these conclusions and not be in jeopardy of hellfire,
mm-hmm.
you know, not, you know, be at odds with your parents or whatever. I just really believe there's a way to do Christianity that bears good fruit, even if I'm never going to participate in it as a believer. And so I guess I've just started to see that as something that I care about, and whether or not I'm invited as a participant, I don't, that's not the point to me. There's this thing that I think if we all pay a little closer attention could go better than it's going. And so if I can help that get, you know, that process, then I'm gonna, cause yeah. I care. It's beautiful to me, you yeah. know? So some people are still uncomfortable having me speaking of the process, and I understand, but I'm gonna, you know, like yeah. I am participating in the larger Christian tradition. That's what I was born into. That's the language I know. That's how I understand ethics, you know? So that's my subject. I'm a son of evangelical Christianity, you know, and I'll never not be that.
Yeah. It's good. Well, before they come and
kick us out. I'm all packed, so.
Good. Thank you.
Oh, you're for thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
I catch little glimpses of what you got going on, and the thing that I really like is it's confusing. It's not what you expect.
Interesting.
And that's good to me. Like I'll sometimes with people, like you just see their output and nothing's sort of like, you know, nothing is, they picked a theory and they're just kind of like applying that. And yeah. I don't feel that from you. I feel like your theory is evolving in a way that very you see so. Little glimpses of it in your communications, and you're wrestling with it, and you're, you know, like there's like a hot take aspect to it too, where you're really trying to like, I feel like you're trying to pastor people who are paying attention and trying to give them stuff to chew on. And it's nice to see it. And like I say, in a sea of just like, yep, yep, yep. It's like, oh.
The O among the Yeps.
Yeah, the O among the Yeps. It's nice. It's nice.
I appreciate that.
So good work.
Thank you, man.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the At Sea Podcast. Music for this episode comes from several of David Bazan's albums, but most notably his recent release, Blanco, which is available at iTunes and at David Bazan, B-A-Z-A-N, Bazan.com. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can actually listen to 20 minutes more of it by visiting atseaevents.com. As we were setting up mics and whatnot, David and I talked about Stephen Colbert, Malcolm Gladwell's podcast on the effectiveness of satire, and David's disappointment in Bob Dylan. It's a pretty interesting conversation that just didn't have much context in the rest of this interview. Regardless, check that out at atseaevents.com. If you like what we're doing with the podcast, and we hope you do, please leave us a positive review at iTunes and share this episode with a friend. Until next time.